Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I am Yuyun Zhan, host of our monthly podcast, Zhonghua Mundus, that brings you recent updates about China's economy. As usual, I am with our senior fellow, Alicia Garcia Herrero. Hi, Alicia. Good to have you with us.
Very happy to be here.
Also joining us today for the first time is Finba Birmingham, senior correspondent for Europe at South China Morning Post. Welcome to The Sound of Economics, Finbar.
Thank you, Yuyun. Nice to be with you.
Thank you for joining. As the world's two biggest economies battle it out over trade, Europe is increasingly finding itself in the middle, economically tied to both, but politically pulled in opposite directions. Today, we are breaking down the US-China trade war, as well as its implications for Europe. So I just want to make a disclaimer that we are recording this episode on Thursday, 24th of April in Brussels morning times, because the trade situation is evolving so fast these days. So listeners, please take our analysis with a grain of salt. Alicia, could you give us a quick recap of where we currently stand on the US-China trade dispute?
I'm not sure I'm in best place. I think nobody is in in the best place to answer that question, because you should probably, and not nobody, but you should be in the negotiations, which I'm not. I don't know, Finbar, how much you know about that. But let's put it this way. I can tell you what I think is happening on the basis of, you know, like public information. Yeah. And I think where we are is that we're negotiating. According to, you know, Trump in his meeting with Meloni, we're 100% there, but we are still not there. So, you know, there has to be something that is not yet agreed upon. In between, we also saw a few fines here and there on U.S. tech companies, which may not have been well swallowed in the U.S. So, you know, I wonder whether that 100% has been reduced since. But also, and this is very important because at the end of the day, this is Zhonghua Mundus, we have had what I would call, I don't know whether the word is capitulation, that's too big, but maybe like a wake-up call, clearly, from Trump, and I would say his administration, that he just needs a deal with China, something. He needs to lower these tariffs. So in a way, I think we were negotiating, it looked good. We did a little bit of a misstep. I mean, I'm not saying we shouldn't have fined these companies, but misstep from the U.S. perspective. But we also now realize that the U.S. might be very busy negotiating with China. I think that's where we are, at least from my reading of the situation. Because when the elephant in the room, i.e. China with these massive tariffs, comes into the picture, I think the U.S. might actually rethink all of these 90 days. I mean, and this is Europe. Europe is still big. But imagine if you are at the end of the queue in importance. I think this changes everything, this China thing, all of a sudden, because the importance of the negotiations for others, including Europe, loses a little bit of steam. And I just worry about that, because we might come, and I can tell you, because I've been following Japan, for example, with Besson, and the messages have changed at the very same time that we have heard about, well, we want to lower tariffs with China. So based on my, you know, kind of reading of what's going on with Japan, I just kind of worry that maybe our negotiations may be, I wouldn't say put fully aside, but may change in nature. Because this is a triangle, yeah? And if China offers something, and we haven't even talked about China's charm offensive. I wanted to say warm offensive, maybe it's too much. Charm offensive on Europe, yeah? So this is like a telenovela. I mean, the U.S. was kind of, okay, we were there. This is Meloni times. That's like Stone Age already. Then we make a misstep. Then the U.S. says, I want China first. Then China comes to us, I want you first. Wow, you know, how can we know what's going to happen? It's very complicated. But the worst of all scenarios for Europe is that, you know, out of this triangle, the U.S. and China get a deal, quick deal, and we're out. And we're totally out. And I think that is very worrying for Europe at this current juncture.
Can I just say something on that quickly? I mean, it's interesting that you see the rhetoric and the Chinese propaganda, the readouts of the meetings. Like Wang Yi spoke with David Lammy, the British Foreign Secretary, on, I think on Monday or Tuesday, and also the Austrian Foreign Minister on the same day. At every turn, they're making the point that they're doing this. What they're doing is they're fighting with the United States for the multilateral system. So this is the message that they're trying to put out there. We're doing this for you, Europe. I wonder if there's plenty of people in Europe who would be ready to swallow that line. But I think you're right, Alicia. It's so hard to understand where we are at this current moment because things are changing so quickly. Like, you know, the EU-China summit is supposed to be in July, and I think they've purposely scheduled it then so that there would be some gap between the 90-day period, and then they could sort of sit down with China. I don't know what the best thing is to do. Should you be speaking to China before that? Should you be working in these sort of 3-4 month terms when the world is changing so drastically, so quickly? Before Alicia and I were speaking in Paris a couple of weeks ago, even during our panel discussion, we had to slightly adjust our conversation because there were tariff announcements going on as we spoke. So to be trying to be in Brussels planning months ahead, when stuff is moving at lightning speed, as you say, the Maloney stuff is all, we're all catching up with what happened with Maloney over the Easter break. It's already out of date. You know, so I'm glad I'm not in the business of making predictions at the moment. It's hard enough just to write the news.
Yeah, I believe it's all been hectic for us in the past weeks. Let's bring back to this big picture that you both mentioned. So, Alicia, some commentators believe that all of these erratic moves that the US is doing, it's not actually erratic, but in fact, they are a more calculated attempt to reshape global trade along the lines of a so-called Mar-a-Lago Accord. You wrote about this in a recent analysis. Could you tell us more about this accord and about whether you think that the US is acting in a calculated manner?
I think there's two interpretations. I wrote twice about Mar-a-Lago, and but just by reflecting on what I wrote, I realized that this concept of Mar-a-Lago is like, I don't know, we celebrated Easter and only recently, I would say the impossible trinity, meaning that there's so many interpretations. So the first one is trade. It's the Plaza Accord is, you know, we need to use exchange rates to, we need prices to adjust trade imbalances as happened in 85. And that's what I first wrote about already months ago, actually, thinking that that's what the US had in mind, that, you know, it was all about exchange rates, a weaker dollar. Now, Bessent just reminded us, we have a strong dollar policy. And I said, where? So even on the dollar, they're ambivalent. We don't really know anymore. But having said that, imagine, yeah, so Plaza Accord equal Mar-a-Lago, i.e. RMB. Okay, that's easy. I think China would not go for that because they have this vivid memory of, maybe exaggerated memory of what the Plaza Accord meant for Japan. In my view, it was not only the Plaza Accord, but China has this vivid memory, oh, Plaza Accord, i.e. bad news for Japan and deflation and you name it. The bubble first and then the collapse of the bubble. But the second piece I wrote is more about the financial Mar-a-Lago, and that's a bit different. It's a little bit off topic, but I'll just a line on that because it does affect China differently. It's not about tariffs now. And it's all about, you know, the US maybe flirting with the idea of reducing the cost of funding for their humongously big public debt. And one way is a nice swap that, you know, people would voluntarily accept. Of course, this is, to me, absolutely unworded and possibly crazy, I would even say, yeah, idea for the reserve currency of the world. But these other, like softer forms of reducing the cost of funding and also the cost of the dollar, i.e. depreciating the dollar, which could go through the Fed, like maybe a new round of QE or financial repression, you name it. Why is this important for China? Because China holds US treasuries. Japan holds US treasuries. And they have a say. I mean, maybe not as big as people may think, to be frank, 600 billion or so is not like massive. If you compare to frankly, Europe holds more US treasury than China. People might not know, but it's just that our holdings are private. So, you know, you're not going to tell anybody don't swap with the US or the opposite. But for China, of course, this is a pact. Yeah, and in that regard, it has more leverage in my view than Japan, because even in Japan, it's not a pact. A lot of the holders are private investors. This brings us a little bit off topic, but it does show, if we want to talk about, you know, China, Europe, and so on, is that China does have a lot of leverage on the US in many ways. We could talk about, this is one. And I think this makes the U.S., beyond the inflationary, you know, impact of tariffs and so on, but also I think it makes it. It has clearly had an impact on Trump's Belt and Show, everyone. I mean, vision of what he's doing, because the big stop in reciprocal tariffs came only hours after they were introduced, and the main reason, in my view, was the U.S. Treasury sell-off. So that is significant. Therefore, we cannot separate. We cannot just say, okay, here are the tariffs, and this little, you know, sell-off is something else, because it is all interrelated. But it also means that Europe has less leverage. Yeah, first, because we do not control these holdings. These are private investors. We cannot tell them, again, what they need to do with the U.S. Treasury. So because of the simple fact that we're a market economy with a free and floating exchange rate, we don't have the situation that China now can use in its favor with the US negotiations.
Finba, do you want to chip in here?
Yeah, without sort of getting in as a non-economist, I mean, how I look at this is that there's a sort of like conveyor belt of sane washing, of trying to sort of, first of all, people are trying to, in Donald Trump's circles, are trying to use theory to explain what he's doing. And I think some of those people around him do have firm ideas about what they want to do. I mean, this guy Mirren has clearly thinks that maybe this is a good idea, but they're trying to apply their theories of what they think Trumpism is to what Trump's actually doing. And that's very difficult when Trump is Trump, because he just sort of moves very erratically. And so you have this sort of reverse engineering, and you're trying to sort of like adapt your sort of theories to fit what this very unintelligible beast is doing. And then you have a second tier of sane washing, where we, journalists and analysts, are looking at these theories and then trying to also perceive what they mean. So we're looking at this sort of Mar-a-Lago accord proposal, and we're trying to then... So you've got people trying to explain what Trump is doing through these theories in his inner circle. And then we're the second tier trying to unpick that. And I think that it's really challenging, and I don't think it's very wise. I mean, I always go back to what Alan Beatty at the FT says in his really entertaining and long thread on Blue Sky. He sort of says regularly, "Welcome to Donald Trump's trade policy. Nobody knows anything." And I think that's probably the safest way to analyze this at the moment. Like, it looks as though people around Trump have ideas, but Trump is the biggest stumbling block to all of these ideas. As we've just discussed, he sort of moves on whim. You know, he sees something happening in the market he doesn't like, and he changes course. A lot of people around Trump definitely want to contain China. I think the biggest opponent to that is probably Trump himself, who wants to do a deal with China. So without sort of really getting into the economic nitty gritty, I see this cottage industry of podcasts and publications trying to sort of make sense of what's going on. And I'm somebody who really can't make any sense of it whatsoever. So I wonder whether we should just stop trying to sane wash these things.
That's a good point, because we do see how Trump is moving erratically, and sometimes you can't just, you know, use a theory to make sense of it. So let's bring the conversation back to the EU, as you have both mentioned in the opening. This escalating US-China trade war, is it already having an impact on the EU? And in the near to medium term, what do you assess the impact of this trade will be on the EU's economy? Alicia, maybe you can start.
Well, I mean, again, there's too many cases missing, I mean, moving at the same time. So let's imagine that we have a deal with the US, so there's no tariffs. And China maybe reduces the tariffs. But, you know, for me, anything that is above 60 is a closed market. I mean, China would have to really deflate massively, yeah? Depreciate the currency, deflate to withstand such high tariffs. So even if they go down, we would still be in this scenario, in actually quite a positive scenario for Europe in terms of exporting to the US, yeah? Because China becomes less competitive, basically, compared to Europe. And this is true, maybe not for EVs, but it's true for chemicals. So there could be a little bit of reindustrialization for some products where China competes till today with Europe on the US market. Let's not forget that the US market is the biggest market for Germany and for many European countries. So, you know, it is just bigger than China. So in that regard, this is a positive shock if we avoid the tariffs. I would put it this way, as simple as that. Of course, there is indirect shocks. Yeah, if China, I don't know, plummets because of the tariffs, well, this is a global negative shock. But I'm just not looking at that now. But of course, the others, imagine the opposite scenario, that the US rushes into literally lifting, which is not what Trump said, but totally lifting tariffs on China, or, you know, huge exemptions, you name it. I mean, it looks as if they exist, but they don't matter. Yeah. And instead, Europe is very slow. And, you know, we get into a discussion. I don't know whether it's opening to US tech or, you know, whatever. Yeah. And then we get tariffs. Well, that's a very different. So what I'm trying to say is that it's very hard to know now what will be the impact on the European economy. But there is one channel that is already there and that will not go away. And this is Finbar's comment, which is uncertainty and the impact on investment. If I'm a European company, the last thing I'm going to do today is to invest because I don't know where. I just don't know where. Should I invest in the US? Maybe not. Maybe, you know, I won't even be allowed to increase investment in the US because now CFIUS is going to go full wind into covering greenfield. So I may as well see what's going on with CFIUS or, you know, Europe. Maybe have tariffs. China, maybe the tariffs are not lifted. So I just think that the negative impact on the global economy is already there independently on the level of tariffs and the distribution, which is through investment and uncertainty. Uncertainty, i.e. less investment. Yeah.
Yeah, we've all seen the turmoil of the stock markets, like whenever this tariff announcement comes out. Finbar, do you want to add anything in here?
Not really. I mean, I'm somebody who reads Alicia's analysis of the economic impact very closely. I mean, look, I mean, I suppose the one that wasn't mentioned there is the second order impact of if these high tariffs on China remain. I know that European policymakers are very worried about the rerouting of Chinese overcapacity to Europe. So what impact does that have on local industry in Europe already under pressure? Are we going to see a flood of cut price goods? I know that there's been some pushback against this theory from people like Simon Evanett. We'll see. But I know that this is something that is informing the sort of flurry of diplomacy between the EU and China at the moment, is that they see this sense of urgency, you know, and you know, Chinese goods seeking an alternative market. So it's something that I'm watching very closely.
Finbar, let me come back to you again. You have been covering Beijing's recent diplomatic moves toward Europe, like Alicia also mentioned, the warm charm offensive. In particular, we have seen recent reports that suggest that China is considering lifting its sanctions on several members of the European Parliament, possibly in the hope of resurrecting CIE, the famous EU-China Comprehensive Agreement of Investment. Could you tell us a bit more about what China is offering and what is the EU's reaction seems to be so far?
Yeah, as we say, it's Thursday 24th. Last night, we reported that the sanctions will be lifted on some of the MEPs, possibly as soon as in the coming weeks. These are retaliatory sanctions that China put on EU lawmakers, but also some ambassadors, the Political Security Committee, think tankers, Merricks and others, in response to the EU sanctions for human rights abuses in Xinjiang. So there's no indication that the EU will lift tariffs in response, because their baseline is that these are not these are there for a reason. You know, the Chinese retaliation is there as retaliation, and so it's easier for them to lift the sanctions rather. Look, China has made no secret that it wants to resurrect the Kai. They've been saying this publicly and privately for years. I'm very skeptical. I think that we're unlikely to see the resurrection of that deal. It was considered underwhelming in 2020 when it was signed, and the world has changed dramatically since then. So even though things are improving between the European Parliament and China, I think that there's probably a low chance of the CAI returning in its current form. Von der Leyen herself has said that it would need to be renegotiated if they wanted to do it. I think what we're looking out for is why I think this is interesting is because it's the first concession that we've seen China is willing to make. It's a minor one. I think it has symbolic value. In the grand scheme of things, it's not enormous. But in light of what's happened over the last few months, it's certainly interesting. We've seen a concession from the EU as well. Von der Leyen and Costa are going to Beijing for the summit in July, even though the summit is supposed to be in Brussels. So if you look at it in terms of a scoreboard, that's one concession each. Now, what is on the table if the CAI is not on the table? You know, we have seen in the readout of von der Leyen's call with Premier Li Qiang that they're discussing some sort of mechanism for tracking over capacity. The sense I have, and Alicia and I have discussed this before as well, is that there may be some sort of a quid pro quo on the table whereby China gets a deal on EVs, a price undertaking arrangement whereby there will be a minimum price in exchange for some sort of a mechanism to monitor overcapacity. Again, for two reasons on this front, I would be a little bit skeptical. The first is on a technical level. Last year, when I was reporting intensely on the EV issue, DG Trade people were telling me how complicated this is to do price undertaking for something as advanced as EVs. This is a dynamic market that changes quickly. There's so many different models, new ones coming on all the time. So to have a minimum import price, it would have to be so highly dynamic that it would be incredibly hard to police and incredibly hard to land on something that would be agreed by both sides. Now, if you add to that something as complicated as a system for monitoring overcapacity in the Chinese system that China doesn't even really acknowledge exists, I find it really difficult to understand how they would come to that such an agreement. That's before you even think about the politics of this. Politically, it's taken months and years of talks for China to lift these sanctions on some MEPs. From what I understand, I don't know that they're going to lift them on Reinhard Bütikofer, for who has left the parliament. And there's no indication that they will be lifting the sanctions on think tankers, which I think is the most important element, because they're the ones who are losing out the most because they can't go to China to do their research. So if it takes so long for them to get to this concession, what makes us believe that China will make a big sweeping concession on trade and investment and so on? I don't know. Colour me sceptic on that one. I think it's interesting to follow where this is going. I mean, I have to watch the daily drumbeat. And sometimes, as I was saying, it's difficult to take a step back and see the big picture. But look, watch this space on the sanctions. We'll see if it's the start of something. But, you know, expectations are managed.
Thank you for that, Alicia. I saw that you're waving your hand.
No, that no means I totally agree, but it's like, oh my God, are we here again? You know, are we back to the same discussion? I can't believe it. Because Kai was put on the refrigerator because of the sanctions or because we actually didn't like Kai. I mean, many didn't at the parliament and I think in some capitals, and it was a little bit rushed, let's face it. And it had a boomerang effect on the Biden administration because, you know, they basically felt, this was even before Biden came, you know, like the inauguration came about, and we had some, you know, difficult discussions at the Trade and Technology Council on this issue when it started. So, you know, you can see that it was not free. And on top of that, it didn't happen. So, you know, it's really amazing that we're back to square one of these. And that we are rethinking of taking Kai out of the refrigerator. By the way, the world is different since we put it in the refrigerator in March 2021. Yeah, it's pretty different, let me tell you. On the one hand, and I just wrote an op-ed for The Wire on exactly this, we have Trump. He's not going to like it. But the whole reason why I wrote this op-ed that I hope will come out maybe today or tomorrow is that it's, even if we forget about Trump, we need to see major benefits to engage in this, yeah? Major benefits. So what are the benefits? So we see our exports clearly decreasing in China. I mean, even compared to average exports into global exports into China, European exports are doing less well. Everybody's doing less well, but we're doing even worse. Our companies in China, and this is the EU Chamber survey, I mean, we've worked with this data. Their sentiment is plummeting, and this was not COVID, this was post-COVID. So, you know, the main variable, as in we've analyzed in this research, is profitability. They are no longer profitable. So do they want a deal? Well, unless things change dramatically, yeah, because this is a market where they're no longer being, it's not El Dorado, it's not no longer what it used to be. On the contrary, it's becoming tougher and tougher. And the third one, which I think is explains a lot of the current, you know, shaky movements, if you want, among some of our member states, including Spain, is, oh, we want your investment, Greenfield, here, come here, not there, come here. And this is, as everybody knows in Brussels, a race to the bottom because, well, okay, if the average, you know, like argument, if it were EU level kind of decision would be, okay, tech transfer, JVs, you name it, each country will kind of give a little bit less or ask for a little bit less to get this investment. And we also know that what China is going to ask in exchange is to lift, as Fimber said, to lift the only import tariffs of relevance we have, which are on EVs, which look ridiculously low compared to what Trump is doing. Yeah, so that little thing, however, our market is much bigger for EVs than the US by all means. It's like over 55% of the market, or probably now even more. They want us to lower those tariffs. But as an economist, I kind of get it. If we lower them, why invest in Europe if they can actually export with much bigger margins because it's the production is cheaper in China, it's more efficient, everything. So in a way, what they're asking us to do goes against our objective. Yeah, so why would we do this? I mean, this is my question is, forget about Trump. Why would you engage in a different, like a closer relation, economic relation, let alone a treaty like something like CAI, which is going to stay there forever, given the time it's going to take to even ratify? Why would you engage in this? And I didn't even mention Trump. So imagine, just in its own right, it doesn't pay off. So for me, it's mind-boggling that we're even considering this.
Well, Alicia, can I just ask you, I mean, my sense of I would be really surprised if there was a treaty or some sort of a thing that was signed, because politically, I think that would be impossible to get member states backing for. We haven't mentioned Russia. I mean, look, that stuff's still going on. Zelensky last week and this week coming out. Like, if you're a Central or Eastern European state, you know, that's still imperative, right? Maybe less so than some countries in the West of Europe. But I mean, my guess would be that rather than a sort of grand bargain between the EU and China, you may see a bit of a ceasefire, like an agreement or like a sort of maybe even an unspoken agreement that there won't be any of these big ticket things that sort of pick a fight. So the steady drumbeat of trade cases will continue. Maybe there's some safeguarding actions to deal with the rerouted overcapacity, but maybe not something blockbuster like the EV probe or maybe even the BYD FSR thing. I don't have any sort of grand insight on that front, but that's just instinctively, I guess there will be a sort of a down, put your weapons down. Let's just sort of agree to disagree on these things.
Yeah. Like Finbar, let me ask you then. We met first in Hong Kong, I still remember, both red hair, you know, in the middle of. So, you know, there is some connection here that, you know, that explains this this vibe. But Finbar, haven't we fought, I don't know, for ages to have this defensive toolkit? Suddenly we say, you know what? I built all of this, took me forever. I had all of these, civil servants working on it, you know, at no avail, because now I'm going to, just because of this charm offensive, I'm going to just lower, I mean, kind of hide, if you want, bury all of this toolkit for the sake of exactly what? What's the deal? What is the, other than lifting sanctions, which nobody remembers, what is China offering? I don't get it. Greenfield?
I agree with you. I mean, I don't think that using the trade defense instruments is escalatory. I mean, those are there to be used, and those will be used in response validly to trade policy and economic policy and activity going on in China. I don't see that as being hugely escalatory. What I mean is, I suppose, I don't expect there to be any huge, you know, for example, the change in tone, like the von der Leyen speech on de-risking and these sort of set piece things, which position us in a very clear position vis-a-vis China. I don't think you're going to see anything like that. I think that the tone of things will change. I think things, business as usual, will happen, like the drumbeat of trade cases. I mean, that you don't put the genie back in the bottle there. We've already discussed that the sort of second order impact of overcapacity in the Chinese economy may worsen. So no, I don't think that you hold fire on the tools that you have. I just don't think that there will be any appetite from member states, particularly, to pick a fight with China that would sort of garner these huge big headlines like von der Leyen has been doing over the last 2 years. That's not to say you reverse course, so to speak. I don't expect there to be a detente. I think that there's too much water under the bridge. We've mentioned Russia, we've mentioned overcapacity. But in terms of the tenor and tone of things, I'd be surprised if it wasn't a little bit cooler and calmer.
But I don't think China will be satisfied with the tone of things. I don't think what China is doing will be, you know, will feel, I mean, again, satisfaction will come from tone, because China needs markets.
But China, that's all, China's offering the tone as well. I mean, what's the real offer here from China, as you said? So if both parties are saying, okay, let's keep talking. I mean, negotiations can be suitable for both sides. They're signals to the United States from both parties. Look, we're talking, you know, so that propaganda can be played however each side likes it, right? So it's a bit like the EV talks towards the end of last year. I mean, I thought my sense of it was this was just a circus. It suited the commission to do the talks because it could say to Germany and Sweden and whoever else wanted a deal, look, we're engaging with China in good faith, even if we don't think a price undertaking agreement is possible. And for China, they were able to say, look, we're at the table with the Europeans. That relationship is still good enough. We're not killing each other. So, you know what I mean? So sometimes that the optics are maybe not as important, but they can be important also.
So maybe the title for an op-ed, the next one, would be China, Europe. As you said, it's not a détente. It's not a full rapprochement. It's flirting, put it this way. It's all about the U.S., they just want the U.S. to see them flirting, but there's no substance.
As I've seen, there was an unknown user. I can't remember who this person was. Just a random person on Twitter, on X, posted something a few weeks ago, said the EU has reinstalled Tinder. You know, that's the best analysis I've seen of what's going on. You know, you sort of shop around. You see what you can get from whoever's willing to come to the table. You know, as von der Leyen said in a couple of her speeches, this is a hyper-transactional world. I'm not sure if Europe, as a 27-member bloc, can be so transactional, but we can at least try.
Okay, I like that. Okay, I was worried you would come with a big bargain being discussed and... But if you say it's just Tinder, so be it. I don't mind.
Just a bit of fun.
Maybe we can look forward to that piece, Alicia. Okay, so I'm going to ask you to give a closing remarks now. Given everything that we've discussed here, maybe I'll start with you, Finbar. What would be the top recommendation to you policymakers looking to navigate these choppy geopolitical waters?
I mean, look, I begin it with, as I said throughout, nobody knows what's going on. So, but I mean, I think you do, I mean, that you do have to be flexible. You do have to sort of understand that these are different times. You know, and I think we have seen that. You know, I think that the Commission has been quite careful with how it's spoken in recent months. There hasn't been a huge rush to react to every single thing that Trump's saying. And as much as that kills me as a journalist who wants a headline every day, I think that's probably smart. I think you do cut deals with whoever you can, but they have to be deals that suit Europe. Don't just do a deal for the sake of it because you want to give the other guy a black eye. I think this is what happened with the Kai. Merkel wanted to rush this over through the last days of the German presidency of the EU. So I think you take what you can get from those on the terms that suit you. Be flexible. I think we've seen this with the decision to go to Beijing instead of, because Xi Jinping doesn't want to come to Brussels, I suppose. Okay, a lot of people would say, well, you shouldn't be going to Beijing if he doesn't want to go to Brussels. But if you know that the Chinese system doesn't do anything unless you speak, if that's your suspicion, unless you speak to the top guy, then you may as well give it a shot, right? You may not get anywhere. I mean, that's probably the suspicion, but at least then you can say you tried and it didn't work. So I suppose that flexibility is important, and I think that that should and probably will continue.
Thank you for that, Alicia.
Not much to add other than it's been a pleasure to have Finber in the show because we really had fun. I hope our listeners have fun too. And I guess we just said this is too complex. I mean, it's just, but we also said, which is Finber's last point, and I think it's very important, that while being very complex, at least we have not yet made at least European institutions major mistakes, off to China for a big deal, or at least if I hear you correctly, Finbar, or maybe just give up, accept any demands that Trump may have had. And I think so far, I think it's been quite, I'd say, I mean, for 27, and they were quite flexible, quite lean. And I think that we should realize that it could have been much worse. And I think that is the message I want to give to the audience, that no matter how bad it looks, so far we've been wrestling elegantly on these two fronts, China and the US. And it could be better, but it could have been so much worse. And so I think we were lucky, by the way. We're also lucky because we were about to massively retaliate, and the gong came right on time from Trump on the 9th of April. But having said that, I think to be frank, I think the commission has managed quite well to work on this. Lower the voice with China, but not really jump on it, embrace and forget about the US or the other way around. So let's see what we can do, but so far so good.
Well, that's ending on a cheerful note,
Yeah,
and
I
I
never
hear
do.
both of you. Yeah, which is a rare thing that happens in our podcast. So I think that is hopeful, like given how erratic the world is. So at least giving us some hope there. We will hear more announcements, I'm sure, and hope the EU can still charter the water. Thank you very much for joining this conversation. I am Yuyun Zhan, and I am with Alicia Garcia Herrero from Brugge and Finbar Birmingham from South China Morning Post. For listeners, you can find all our research on China at brugge.org and sign up for Zhonghuan Mundus, our monthly China podcast and newsletter, with link in the show notes. Until next time, bye bye.